This week's conversation with Ruth Norbury of Gothic Decay is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. Kim and the folks at Sassy Jack's are getting ready to open their new Forever home this fall, and the latest report is the opening will be soon. Be sure to check out the full collection of Sassafras sampler charts, including Alice Ellen Usher, 1873, Christian Henry, 1816, and Elizabeth Cooper, Jesus Wept. Many of the Sassafras charts are available as PDF downloads, and Kim will be happy to put together kits for all of them. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com and plan to visit when the new shop opens this fall. And now, on to our conversation with Ruth Norbury of Gothic Decay. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Gothic Decay, Ruth Norbury. Ruth, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This was so much fun to do the research on. Just interesting how you get to your art.
Very kind. Thank you.
It's amazing stuff. All right. So let's get a little background in. What got you involved in textile arts? Stitching with your mother, or what was it?
When in primary school, actually, when I was about six, we did a cross-stitch snowflake for Christmas. And, that was it. I got hooked on that. I made it wrong. Instead of putting all the square, you know, all the crosses up together, I put a space in between them for some unknown reason. But I just loved it. And so then, because when you're little, they're quite expensive. Asked for them for pocket, you know, with my pocket money, and asked for them for Christmas and birthdays, little kits and things. And any magazines I could find, I'd do the little kits on the front. Didn't matter whether I liked them or not. I just did whatever I could find, really. And that's how it all began.
That's so cool. So there wasn't even a dropout as you grew up. You just kept doing them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Just all the way through school, if I'd read at homework or whatever else it was, you know, I would just settle down to whatever kit I had and get on with that. So then I started to move on to stencils then when I'd run out of kits. And so I would just, because I have no art background at all, so I would outline the stencil on the fabric and then just color it in with embroidery. That's how it all began.
So there's no art background at all. Did this spark an interest, or it was just something you did on the side because you enjoyed it?
No, I passionately hated art. Really, really hated it. I enjoyed textiles, but I hated art really, really badly. And there's no art background. I wanted to be a what I thought was a forensic scientist, but turns out to be a pathologist. But there's about 6 years of medical school and then pathology training after that, so that wasn't going to happen. So a little bit of a career path change, but, you know.
hey, whatever works. So what is it about textiles, then, that attracts you? I mean, obviously, the way you do your art, that's all textile. What attracts you? You just like working with cloth and thread?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose when I grew up, my mum would be making all our own clothes and all that kind of thing. So I suppose I'd just sit in the corner and play. So, I mean, whether it be colouring in or whatever it might be. So I suppose I've been sort of surrounded by fabrics and textiles for my life, really. But I've never really got on with dressmaking particularly well. So embroidery was my direction for some reason. Don't know quite why.
can't tell you how many guests we've had who started out in some form or another with dressmaking or sewing on a machine of some kind, and just, nope, not for me.
I think I'd probably be all right at it. I was just, you know, I have had a few disasters in the past with a skirt that made me look like I had a bottom the size of Canada, but it was not ideal. Yeah. I won't be doing that again.
Yeah, well, let's... People, I'm sure, have not seen, a good number of them have not seen your art, so... what Ruth does is she takes a photo, a reference photo, and she interprets and recreates that all with cloth and thread and painting on dyes, and comes up with some amazing things. And visit her website, gothicdecay.com, or watch the video that we put on YouTube to see the photos of her work. So what takes you down that path? I mean, a cross stitch is one thing, but what you do is so far removed from making X's that, they aren't even related. What takes you down that path? Was it a progression of embroidery and trying different needle and thread things?
Exactly that. I started making hand embroidered birds. Before that, I did a few sort of Aztec designs where I just coloured in, traditional Aztec designs, long, long time ago. And then I started hand embroidering birds, quite intricate, detailed pieces. And basically, I realised that although I like birds, I have nothing wrong with birds. The pieces weren't very me. I wasn't bringing out much of my own personality, I suppose, in them. So I spent years and years trying to find me and what I wanted to produce. Because I suppose in the world of textiles, you're very much shown things on a very basic level that are quite gardeny and flowers and pretty things. And although, again, I like gardens and flowers and pretty things, they're not kind of what I would choose to make myself. So it was a long process of trying to work out what I wanted and what I liked and how to get it to fit together.
So during this process, though, there's a voice inside of you that is telling you that there's a way to express yourself, and it's just driving you to find it?
Yes, it's kind of, try this. And so you try it and go, yeah, sort of, it's better, but still not really quite what I'm looking for. So I didn't, I'm not very good at treading my own path. I'm very much a follower by nature. I like to do what I'm told and follow instructions. So it probably took me longer than it would other people to try and find a way.
But did you take any like mixed media classes? Or follow things online that are mixed media, because when I see your work, it reminds me of some mixed media techniques that I've done.
I did a year of City and Guilds embroidery, but to be honest with you, I didn't really look at other people's work because I didn't want to be sort of influenced by it. That sounds a bit arrogant, doesn't it? I don't mean that, but. Sometimes if you see a lot of things done in a certain way, you tend to sort of, without really meaning to, head off in that direction. Right. So I suppose things like, graphic novels, comic book art kind of thing, the sort of darker, that kind of thing was sort of more pulling me, and the sort of slightly creepy, abandoned-y kind of things. And eventually, through various... some successful, some not successful, some very not successful pieces. We've ended up here.
That's so interesting that you say that you don't want to be influenced, because I'm a magazine editor, have been for 45 plus years, and I have never made it a practice of reading competitive magazines for that very reason. I really don't want to know what they're doing, because I need to do that, or I need to do this, or if that's what the competition is doing, we need to be doing this. And I've always felt that way. You need to just find your own path. Oh, that's so interesting you say that.
No, that's nice. Cause I'm not the world's most confident person. And as I say, I'm a follower, not a leader. So it's very nice to find others who do the same thing.
Yeah. So the is it the what comes first, the architecture or the art? Or yes.
yes. How do you mean the which
what? In as you're going through this process, is it you want to express architecture, or you're just finding a way, you want to find a way to create art?
I think to create art using something that I'm trying to add a certain amount of, I'm not creepy again, but sort of something that's just slightly unsettling. I particularly like the depiction of post-apocalyptic worlds and that kind of thing, and sort of imagining what would be important in life. And if you've got a grotty old abandoned building that's all tumbly down, well, that actually might be incredibly important compared to the, I don't know, the diamond ring or the brand new, you know, fast car or whatever it might be, which becomes pretty useless pretty quickly. So, you know, this, what level of shelter kind of thing would be more important to you, I suppose. So it's trying to get that across, I suppose.
And you live in an area where there's lots of abandoned buildings that you can draw from?
There are quite a lot, yes. It's getting a lot better than it was, but yes, there are. I live in South Wales in Swansea, and it's not the richest part of the world. It's not it's not like nasty or anything like that. It's beautiful. There's the Gower just down the, you know, just a few miles away from me. But yes, there are quite a lot. We've got a lovely old abandoned theatre, which they've just started to. They're turning it into office space, oddly, but they're going to keep the vibe of the theatre. So there was a lot of kind of inspiration there, and lots of lovely old buildings that are just slowly bits dropping off them and slowly getting sadder and sadder until eventually they'll, you know. But yes, yeah.
So that old theatre building is going to survive then?
Yes, it is, yes.
Oh, good, because it's beautiful.
It is lovely. We were lucky enough to have a tour inside it while it was still, you know, the people went in, they bought it, the council. They went in, they sort of basically shored up the bits that were going to drop on people and then allowed people to have a little look round. And it was just amazing to see, really was. Beautiful old theatre all just, you know, crumbling to nothing.
Yeah.
But, they are hopefully going to stick it all back together again and keep that, like I say, that sort of theatre-y vibe. They're going to use the sort of stage area as a kind of a meeting area, I think, so everyone can kind of look down on it still. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with it. But it's beautiful, beautiful old building.
Glad it's going to survive. See, that's a whole area of photography, particularly in large inner cities that, you know, where there's just a lot of decay, is to go in and photograph old rundown buildings. And there's a lot of photographers who will go find abandoned houses and go in and photograph, you know, with the wallpaper in a kitchen or whatever it might be. And so the photos that you used showed in your first video all spoke to that the decay, but there's so much art and there's so many things going on in those old buildings that, you know, you don't fix them up. You know, let me take some more pictures.
Absolutely. No, you don't want them to come down completely, but if we could just all take some nice photographs before that'd be
right,
lovely.
Right.
Sort them all out.
Yeah. So that, so you're working your way, just trying to express yourself. And, I mean, you create your background cloth, you just piece it together. Where is that? You know, just go buy a piece of cloth. Why piece it together?
I suppose I've never been a huge fan of just seeing a piece of embroidery plonked in the middle of a very plain bit of fabric. And I used to do it lots and lots, and I couldn't think why it was I didn't like it. And there was all this sort of intricate stitching and then just nothing, just almost like a blank piece of paper with a sort of incredibly sort of intricate thing in the middle of it. So I thought, I wondered what would happen if I sewed a few pieces together. And then I thought, well, that looks silly. And so because I couldn't find my scissors, I held it up in an incredibly not safe manner, decided to shove a knife in it and just sort of tear it down. Realizing I was standing in the window at the time, which probably wasn't the best idea. But then I thought, oh, that's cool. And then it was then too many strips. So I stitched it back together with the Frankenstein stitches. And then I thought, oh, there's promise here. So it's accidental, but kind of, it worked for me, I suppose. It just added that little bit of textured something or other that stopped the embroidery in the middle being sort of isolated, I suppose.
And there's something about doing that collage work on the background, because when I do like mixed media art, I will take, like, sometimes I don't know where to start, so I will grab a bunch of scraps of paper and they don't have, they're just, and just throw them on the page, and then add the next layer. It gives you, you might never see that collage on the background, but it's there. It adds something to the whole piece, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I've started adding a lot more hand embroidery into my work, because that's always the thing that I loved the most. That was what I sort of really started with. And I'll often cover that with bits of, you know, whether it be scrim or paint or whatever it is. And so there's hours and hours of work in there that just won't ever see the light of day. They're all hidden behind things. But I kind of like that for some strange twisted reason.
But it does, but it adds a depth to the piece. I think, you know, you maybe can't see it on a photograph, but that's what draws me in when I see pieces that are done like that, because I'm like, okay, I know it's not, there's more layers in there, and I've got to get really close and see, okay, let me look closer at it. Let me dig deeper.
No, there's a lot going on that, as I say, might not even ever turn up in the final piece. Just, you know, no one will notice, but I know it's there. So, and I suppose it, as you say, adds more depth. So it's not just as flat. They might, you know, you might not know why it's textured, but it's, you know, it's just another layer of something.
Yeah, that was when you were first putting the pieces together to make your background cloth, and you said Frankenstein stitch, and I went, what is she talking about? And then then you showed, and oh, that, really, those crude stitches, as in the way they stitched together Frankenstein in the movies. And then I thought, well, you can't do that, because that'll just scream at me throughout the whole thing. But it doesn't. You make it just become part of the background. It's a fascinating transformation.
Well, thank you. I think it's probably because it's done with a linen thread or a natural thread, so that then when the dye goes onto it, hopefully it dyes everything. And they might be subtly different from the background fabrics, but they should all be quite well integrated. They're not just, you know, if you had a big like white man-made thread in the middle of everything, it would be quite glaring. But I think because it's the dye takes it all up nicely, it gets a much more subtle actual colouring than the Frankenstein stitches will look at the beginning, which you think, oh, how are these ever going to disappear?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, because when you put your background cloth together, when you sew all those pieces together, and I just kind of paused there. Now, what's she going to do? Because it's kind of a scrambled mess in a way, but it has its own character. And I thought, how is she going to make this work? So when you were first developing this, I assume there's lots of cloth that went in the trash just because you couldn't get things to work the way you wanted.
Absolutely. I did a huge piece the size of a single bed sheet.
Oh, my word.
And I stitched it all on the sewing machine, so it was, because I prefer it hand-stitched, but, you know, it doesn't mean you can't stitch it on the machine. And on that scale, it needed to be machine-stitched. And I could imagine, because it was based on a very impoverished area, that's the whole story of the piece, that it was almost like reusing and, you know, mending, and a little bit like the wartime, you know, patching pieces together and just covering up holes and sewing bits on to give extra life to clothing and fabric. That also sort of started it off as well, that, you know, they're thinking of it in terms of, you know, repairing and, you know, reusing actual clothing, as well as, you know, what the fabric is actually made from, you know, where I get the actual fabrics.
Right. Well, and that speaks to the fact that you, thrift stores and charity shops, as you call them, wherever, you don't just go out and buy a bolt of new fabric. You scrounge up and save all kinds of pieces.
I do, yes, absolutely. Pillowcases, bed sheets, all that kind of thing. Pop them in the washing machine, chop them up, turn them into embroidery. What else? But things like, you know, you'll get lovely linen skirts and things like that. That because I work in the thrift store on a just one afternoon. If something, for example, has a stain in it, a skirt with a stain that won't come out, then it goes to what we call the ragman. He's a chap that comes along in a big van and you give him all the things that you can't sell. So instead of that, I put some money in the pot and take home said skirt, chop around the stain, and hey presto, I've got lots of nice linen fabric that's ready to go. So, yeah, it's everyone wins.
So you do you mainly use then things that will accept the dye, or do you sometimes use, because like polyester, I know it'll accept paint, but it won't accept like some of the dyes.
Yes, so it'll be mostly cotton, linen, or something that's mostly cotton or linen. But one of the things I do is I piece together small, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 inch square pieces to start with, and then chop those up, and then Frankenstein stitch them back together again after I've washed them to sort of give them a frayed edge. And so you can then, if you're a bit doubtful as to whether something's going to take dye or not, you could perhaps put it at the edge of an embroidery, because then you can really cover it in a lot of heavy ink, or maybe even put it over a bright area like a window, so that if it doesn't take up as much dye, then that's actually quite useful. So one of the joys is that all the fabrics react slightly differently. So although they're mostly generally similar, you'll get all kinds of different textures and things popping up. And even pieces that might have embroidery already on them, or, you know, textured fabrics. I'm trying to think, embroidery anglais and that kind of thing. They're pretty little sort of areas of stitching into a plain fabric, which then when you dye them, that the stitching will then dye a different colour to the background fabric. And it just creates all kinds of interest. And, you know, like I say, if some of them don't come out so well, then you hide them at the edge and pretend no one notices. No, you just add more dye. And it's the way of the process. It can be quite random when you actually put the dye onto it. So it's one of the joys, is that suddenly a big square will go pale and you think, ah, right, okay. That's not what I hoped for, but we'll work with it. That's what right. nature gave you, so you get on with it.
Oh, because I just know, like, even for those of us the people who do, like, cross stitch, they know that some of the dyers will have the same folds of fabric. They'll stick it in the same dye bath, and for some reason, the dye doesn't take the same linen. And that, to me, is interesting, especially when you're looking at your pieces, because then when you add that layer, it does, no matter what, the fabric takes the dye in a different way. And it's just fun to see how that works, and then to play with it from there. How you work with those pieces.
Yeah, that when it got to the dyeing, so when you got the ground cloth together, and okay, you've got these various shades of white and a few prints and things, and then, all right, we're going to dye it. I thought, oh, here comes the bucket of boiling water on the stove with the dye in it, and we dip it in and we hang it out to dry. And not even close to that. What made you start using a paintbrush and mixing little bits of dye and painting it on? Just playing around again?
Yeah, and I suppose the bit of me that liked hand embroidery and very neat stitching is that, well, you can't go outside the lines. That's not what happens. So I'll need to control this dye. It must do what I want it to do, but it just doesn't happen like that. But you can suggest it goes in certain directions, even if you lose the ultimate argument with it.
And that had to be it. This whole thing is just asking the question, what if, because that had to be a whole nother period of experimentation, just learning what dyes and how to stir up the powders in your little paint pot palette thing there. Must have been just a whole lot of experimentation and waiting a couple days to see what it looks like when it dries. And
The techniques were somewhat limited because I didn't have any money and I didn't want to buy anything new, so I just had to use what I found. So when the charity shop had some of those brush-o powders in, brilliant, I'll take them home and have a play with them and see what they do. So I don't have you know, all the dyes and all the colors and all the, you know, potions and lotions and pots of stuff that most embroideries have, because I've always had this kind of very limited selection of things. So I had these dyes, so that's what I used. And, you know, if I found a little stamp pad, then I'd use some of that in there. Or if I found some ink, then I'd use that. So it's more using what you've, using what you give them, using what you find, rather than kind of necessarily by making it work to what you want it to do, I suppose. Does that make sense, I think?
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. It's plus it keeps the cost down, so why not? Yeah.
But, exactly.
But it was fun watching you work, because I'm sitting there thinking there must be some days where your fingers are just all stained with dyes and stamp ink and everything else.
Generally, yes. And especially if you're making a video or doing something with your hand, something important, you're going to see somebody important. Well, not important, but you know what I mean. You like shake hands with someone, you're like, oh, excuse me, I'm now turquoise. I do apologize. I am quite messy when it comes to these things. I've always generally got bits of spray paint on my fingers, or, you know, general ink and all kinds of mess everywhere.
Yeah. And that board you work on when you dye the fabric, oh, that board, if it could tell stories, holy smokes.
That's seen some use, is that?
Yeah.
It's not in new condition, no. I wouldn't get away with that on eBay.
Hey, keep using it. Yep.
So the still work.
You when you went through at the beginning the evaluation of photography of the for your reference photos, you've looked at a lot of them and studied a lot of them, because as you talked about them, the fisheye lens in one of them, and talking about the perspective and so on and so forth. Are a lot of those your photos, or do you just find photos wherever and try to make them work? And obviously copyright becomes an issue.
Yes, I try and use my own photographs, or I use copyright-free images. As far as I am aware, I will do everything I can to make sure that they are copyright-free. So you can use certain, you know, there are certain websites that you can go to and find copyright-free images that you can use. But ideally, I would use my own, like I was saying, from the Palace Theatre in Swansea, being able to go around and actually see it for yourself, because you get the pictures you actually want to get, you know, the right angle up the stairs, or the, you know, the little sort of, I don't know, little sort of sneaky corner that you just want to have a little look in and things, and you can take exactly what you want then. But obviously, I assume it's the same with over with you, but certainly here it's illegal to go into abandoned places and
start taking photographs.
So you can't do that, obviously. But or you can, you know, ask artists permission as well for use. But I would tend to use my own photographs if I can, or the copyright free ones, but ideally my own. And you can also using things like Photoshop to manipulate photographs to end up, you know, in ways that you might want to use them for that too.
Yeah, a lot of times you just ask for forgiveness. Just go in and ask for forgiveness. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I couldn't be in here. Yeah. So I'll just get right out of here. Yeah, I got, and in your mind, I got the pictures I need. I'm good anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this isn't my house. Oh, right. Okay. I'm sorry, officer.
Yeah, the only thing is make sure you don't fall through a rotten floor, because that's hard to explain. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Probably, yes. Yeah, I was falling through a floor that wasn't mine.
Right. Yep. No, that's how you do it. You just go in, get them, get out. Yep. No one knows. Mm-hmm. Yep. I love the sewing machine. How have you had that? Is that something you acquired or something you've had forever?
No, it's something I acquired. I lived for a while on a narrowboat, and the electricity was somewhat of an issue. So an antique hand-cranked Singer made perfect sense, because you could use it without using up any electricity. And it also spoke to that whole post-apocalyptic thing that she'd probably still run even after the apocalypse. And amazingly, it doesn't matter what you give her to eat, she just sews straight through everything. It's, you know, considering the changes she would have seen that in fabrics and, you know, all the textile techniques and things like that, she'd, yeah, she just eats everything you give her. Lovely, lovely, lovely stitching. It's certainly better than an electric one that I've used, which just sort of went, oh, I couldn't possibly, you know, it's too thick. Oh, no, I don't like it. So, yeah, she's brilliant.
It was so cool to see you using that, though. Those old.
It also, I will admit to not being brilliant on an electric sewing machine. So she works at the same speed I do mentally. So it works brilliantly. If you're feeling a bit slow one day, she's nice and slow. And if you're feeling a bit more with it, you can go nice and straight lines. But you can go really slowly round all the little corners, you know, genuinely one stitch at a time. So it does have a practical purpose as well as looking very cool.
Yeah. Stitching the lines that make up the photo after you've traced it and have the tracing paper attached to the background cloth. Does that looked like it took a lot of time to use the sewing machine to stitch all the lines so that they're defined. Kind of a tedious process in some ways.
Well, not as tedious as tearing off the tracing paper.
Oh, okay.
So, no, it's fine. It's quite nice because you sort of, you get a real feel for the structure of the piece. You know, you've outlined everything onto the tracing paper, but only when you're really sort of feeling the fabrics and the threads that you kind of really, I don't know, you start to see where it's going. You start imagining what bits you're going to paint how and where you're going to put the sewing and, you know, what you might add some stamps or some stencils in or something. You know, you can, it starts to become much more real when you've got the lines in, so you know where your basic outlines are then.
I have a question about those outlines. Does that, do the outlines help keep the dyes in the space and the paint?
Unfortunately not, no. I wish they did, but they don't. No, I mean, they might a little bit, but no, it's generally just been really, really, if you're doing a large area, you put your ink, you know, you're brushing the ink and you do a bit away from the edges first, and then you just slowly get closer and closer to the edge as the ink's starting to run out. So then it almost paints the surface rather than soaking right in, and then because that's when it starts to really spread, is when it's really soaking through the fabric. So you're just sort of almost brushing the top, almost just sort of colouring rather than it sort of spreading in. So it just, yeah. No, unfortunately not. I mean, maybe a little bit, but nothing noticeable, unfortunately.
I was just wondering because I noticed that it didn't seem to spread, and I thought, was that technique or is that those sewing lines she's got there helping her?
Luck, experience, and covering up the whoopsie daisies.
Perfect.
Yeah, that was fun hearing you talk through the videos because. No matter how it went, you were unfazed. It's like, okay, we'll just adjust later, or you know, this is a little dark, we'll lighten it up. And then when you brought out the spray paint at one point and just sprayed it, and it was kind of freeing to listen to you because you just, nothing bothered you in terms of, oh no, this went too dark on me, this is terrible. You obviously have made adjustments on so many pieces that, you know, whatever, we'll make it work another way. Yeah.
That's exactly how I find it. And I think a lot of people, this kind of images of perfection that we have around now, I think it's quite damaging. I'd rather be much more honest and go, yeah, I go outside the lines. That happens all the time. You know, just put a bit of something over it. You know, that's what beads are for. Hide the indiscretions, the things that weren't supposed to happen quite like that. You know, I mean, you do your best to minimize the errors with, you know, experience and, you know, certain tips and tricks, but it will just go outside the lines. I mean, almost every window I've ever done ends up with too much ink in it just because you're trying really carefully to get this pale white bit in the center and no, it's all there, all comes in. So I don't really like that. Oh yes, of course, it's all works first time every time, isn't it all wonderful? You know, no, it doesn't, no. And it makes it more approachable, I think, that, you know, if you're having a go at something and your ink has gone outside the lines, well, then so is mine. So that's all right.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
I hope that comes across like that. Anyway, that's how I want it to come across. Not like, well, she obviously doesn't know what she's doing kind of thing.
No, it was just the kind of the free flow, go, you know, just go with it. We'll adjust later, or let me adjust this now. And the different ways that you found to make the whatever area it was work. And I could just tell that no matter how it went, you had a way out of it somehow to get what you wanted.
Sometimes that way takes an evening of thought, but yes, hopefully it's there are a few of those over time, but yeah, I try and think of it. Somebody once said it's almost like nature and the artist trying to get work together rather than trying to control nature. So let the dye spread all over the place and go where it's not quite supposed to go. And, well, just go with it and cover it up if you don't like what nature did.
Well, that in the piece that you did in the video, and you were working really hard early on to preserve the area around the window because it was, I mean, the window panes were pretty much blown out in the image. And yeah. And then you put the yellow in, and I thought, oh, I think that went too dark. And I thought, well, I wonder what she's going to do with that. Well, just come back with some white and put over the top, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And when they eventually invent some kind of really proper white ink or dye or paint or something, rather, I'll be a very happy bear. Now, that's one of the rings I've normally got white paint on my thumbnails, is because I'm just generally holding a stencil piece down while trying to spray white over the top of whatever's gone the wrong way.
When did you discover stamp pads? Because you first time you showed stamp pads, you were actually doing stamping. And the next thing I know, you got it flipped upside down. You're just going on your piece with the pad itself. Just another form of putting color and...
Yeah, and I think I was trying to do some samples for a scrapbook a long time ago, and I found that just a blank piece of fabric could make whatever you were doing look a bit dull and it looks a bit childish. So I just thought, oh, quickest way to find colour, what have I got? Stamp pad, I wonder if that works, and just rubbed it on the piece of fabric and it did. Or I just stick my finger in it generally when I'm doing a lot of my own work. So yeah, I generally, my fingers are just covered in stuff.
the best tools for putting paint exactly where you want it.
Thank you. Yes, see. And we wouldn't have so many if we didn't need all the different colors, you see.
Right, that's right. But there's 10 digits, right?
Exactly, 10 different colors all at once.
Just gotta,
or
make sure
scratch your nose with.
We all have paint on your nose.
Always.
No, it was so funny with the stamp pads, because I think we're all brought up as kids when there's a stamp pad involved, you know, don't touch it, you'll get ink on your hands. Just put the stamp on it and then put that on the paper and be careful because there's ink that'll get on things. And then, no, not Ruth. Give me that pad. Flip it upside down. Start smashing it on the piece. We'll make it work. Yep.
Sometimes also it's just because you need a different color and you just happen to have the right ink pad. And sometimes if there's, unbeknownst to you, a thread hiding under the fabric and you rub the stamp pad on, that thread will kind of show through a little bit, like, you know, brass rubbing and all that kind of stuff. So it adds more texture and things and bits and bobs to the piece. And again, it's nature playing her part. And as long as you don't get too many stripes from the edge of the stamp pad, you're generally doing all right.
Yep. Now, what you really, all of that, as we're watching this, all of that work is prep work to create the frame and the base for the embroidery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really bring it to life, but I had to chuckle a couple times because I thought, all right, here comes the embroidery. And then the two knots that people literally run from, French knots and bullion knots, and you're using them everywhere.
Yep. Well, oddly enough, my least favorite stitch when I was a child was stem stitch, and all my birds ended up being done in stem stitch. So I seem to just go for the ones that are difficult, really. I think must be some kind of something in my nature. No, I think they're just, French knots are just lovely and sort of, well, they're just the perfect texture for bits of weird rubble and stuff that's fallen from the ceiling of the abandoned place. And just, I don't know, they just seem to, you can make them all different sizes with different thicknesses of threads, and same with the bullion knots. And if they don't quite work and they're a bit wonky or a bit long or there's a bit sticking out, well, it just adds to the texture. So it's all fine.
Right. So you're not aiming for perfection as much as you're aiming for the texture on the piece.
Yeah. I mean, I will admit there is a bit of me that is a perfectionist, and I do like, I get great, a worrying amount of pleasure from getting it just right. But yeah, if it, you know, rubble isn't perfectly round and, you know, perfectly long and stringy like a bullion knot. So just if it doesn't come out right, it doesn't matter. And it's just, I don't know, just if it's just a really big loopy bit, well, then you hide it under another French knot and stick it down and no one will know. It's fine.
Right. And I like how you use the beads, too, to add another dimension to your piece. I think you're working on a piece and you said, oh, wait, it doesn't look like it has enough. And you're...
So, well, again, the thrift stores are perfect places for all the, you know, little bits of jewelry and beads and things that you can just chop up. And particularly the wooden ones seem to work very well in the kind of work that I do. But, yeah, just whatever you find, whatever you've got, if it's not the right color, paint it and stick it on anyway. Be all right.
No, that was the other thing that I took out of this is, you know, no matter where we go shopping, if you see some jewelry, you think, oh, maybe that's something I would wear, or no, I'll never wear that. But your perspective is you got a bunch of beads on there that can be used for something. Grab it, tear it apart, and use those beads for a new purpose. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I've bought some hideous jewelry in my time because it's got some beautiful beads on it. And you tend to get it quite cheaply then because no one else is going to buy it in their right mind. But you think it's lovely because it's got 1,000 little tiny beads that are going to be just right for whatever project you're doing. So,
yeah. No, I mean, because I envision with this conversation, sending a bunch of people off to the thrift store, just buying up a bunch of jewelry, coming home and just tearing it apart on a table and sorting out all the beads. Yep.
Yep. Make it happen.
That's right. Is the embroidery, is that the highlight of the process for you, in that now I get to really bring to life what I've been working on, or is it just another step in the overall creation process?
It's probably the thing I feel most comfortable with because I have no background in art. There's always a bit of panic when you're putting paint or dye or something on somewhere because you're like, oh, it's going to ruin it, it's going to be terrible, oh, what am I doing. But the sewing is something I've done for 39 years, so I kind of know what I'm getting with that, and it's nice and slow, so you can do a French knot and you can go, oh, that worked well, I can put another one next to it. Whereas the dye, you get to a certain level of panic where it's coming the wrong way and no, you need it to go that way and it's not going and things. So it's a much more sort of slow and kind of, I don't know, gentle process, I suppose. You know what you're getting at. And it just adds that the little final touches that that can make it sort of really work and add the sort of the depth, because you can do tiny, tiny French knots if you're doing like a corridor or something like that, or a railway track, tiny French knots in the distance, getting bigger and bigger as you come forward. So it helps to add perspective into the piece of work.
And again, with your thread, just whatever you have.
Yep. Whatever you got. Yeah. Whether it's sewing cotton or, you know, just for dress baking or stranded cotton or wool from the charity shop, the thrift store, whatever you've got. Yeah. If it's the right color, if it isn't, then dye it and yeah, have fun with it. Just big, thick bits, and with beads or things that you've found, you know, bits of rust that you might have found, or washers, or, you know, whatever you've got. And if it, stick it on, have a look, see what you think of it. And if it doesn't look right, take it back off again. So I'd like to say it's a complicated process, but it's in theory, it's not. I mean, sometimes you do get to this point where you're like, it's just not right. In which case I hang it up and sit there with it, you know, while I'm doing other stuff in the evening and just kind of keep glancing back at it from a distance. And quite suddenly, generally, something pops into your head and you go, oh, yeah, there's not enough contrast, or, you know, it's not pointing to the, you know, the focal point's all wrong or whatever it might be. So then you go back and you get the inks and the dyes out and the beads and cover up bits you don't like, and off you go.
It's so interesting to hear you talk, because we've had many conversations about how, as we become adults, that kid in us that will just try anything to see what happens. You know, there's no social restrictions on kids. You know, they just, oh, let's see what happens here. And how artists, above all else, retain as much of that as is possible. And you just seem to have retained it all. And I was thinking, as we were researching, you know, if you'd had formal art classes, how much of that willingness to just try would have been taken out of you? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a very fair point. Yeah, because I suppose I'm always doing something I don't really know how to do. So you're just trying to make it work. And there's no right or wrong way then, because you don't know how to do it. And so, well, let's have a go and see. And generally it comes out. And even if you've gone wrong with dye, you can generally put it in the washing machine and some of it will come out, even if not all of it. Or at the very worst, you can chop it all up and turn it into something else in the future. So, yeah, I mean, I do tend to get stuck in ruts of things. It's not all play, because a lot of the work takes a long time. It's very easy to kind of just make a similar thing that you did before so you don't go wrong. But every now and again, I realize I'm doing that, so start to try and add some more experimental things in. Just because I think you get, not bored exactly, but it just doesn't hold you the same way it used to do and kind of get you all excited about your new threads or your new techniques or whatever it might be. And yes, some of the fear goes, because you know a bit more what you're, you know, if I put this here, I know, you know, the result that's coming out the other side. But it's more fun to sort of have a little play here and there, even if it's a bit more stressful.
So you've talked about fear a little bit. So how do you work through that fear?
Experience, knowing that everyone's going to be a bit for a lot of the piece, and holding it up when it really has gone a bit and thinking, spending a long time just away from it and coming back to it and spotting what's gone wrong or what you can change. But generally you can paint over something or other. So but it can be, especially when you've got a lot of work in the background. Because before you even do the machine stitching, there's hours of work already in there. Then if you've got a day's worth of machine stitching and unpicking all the tracing paper, and then you've got this big pot of dye in your hand thinking, oh, I hope this is the right colour. But I think you need to not have any expectation, or not have too rigid an expectation for something. Because one of the pieces I made, I was hoping would be really yucky, subtle colours and really yummy sort of grungy colours. And it turned out to be really quite bright and happy. And I was like, oh, I was really disappointed when it first dried. And I was sort of, you know, really quite, oh, I'm going to have to put it in the wash now. And then James looked at it, my other half, and he, my husband, and he looked at it and went, actually, I quite like that. I was like, oh, no, it's too bright. Nope. And then I kind of thought, well, actually, maybe there is something there. So I put it in the drawer for a bit, came back to it, and it can still be nice, even if it's not what you were expecting it to be. So if it's what you consider to be a complete disaster, then hide it in a drawer, pretend it doesn't exist for a week, and come back to it.
So do you work multiple pieces then at a time then?
Not generally. I tend to just work on the one at a time. And when I'm waiting for fabric to dry, you know, or something like that, then I'll tend to start patching pieces together. So it's not actual. So it's sort of preparing for the next one, but it's more at the stage where just little pieces of fabric go together and then get chopped up and put in the washing machine. So it's more of the sort of preparation work than actually starting something at the same time. I've never really liked it. I don't know quite why. I think for me personally, I tend to get out of the mind state of what I'm trying to create somehow. Whether something's a bit dark and creepy or a bit sort of lonely, or, you know, what kind of feelings I'm trying to get out of something. You can sort of, not exactly lose them, but they can sort of muddle together a little bit if I've got too many things on the go at once. So I tend to try and stick to one at a time, generally.
The only artist who got mad because her stuff came out bright and happy.
Yes, that's way too pink for me. I don't like it.
Yuck. Is there a progression with your work? Do you feel a progression? Do you try and drive a progression to find new levels? Or are you content with just the experience of creating? I shouldn't say just. Are you content with the creating each one because each has its own story and its own life?
I try and push a bit with each one just because, well, like I said before, I can end up getting into a bit of a rut, and then you feel like, oh, all right, let's get the pieces out and I'll patch them together and then I'll stitch them like this. Right, where's the sewing machine? Stir around them. And you kind of lose the sort of what they're supposed to be about. They become a bit more of a process rather than a, you know, something from inside you. So I try and,
Okay, well, no, it does. Yeah, I just wonder. So there's an awareness there anyway.
Yes. So, yeah, I then will try and do a little bit more. And it's like ultimately with my birds, another reason I stopped making those is that they felt very sort of formulaic after a while. That, yes, you could do things a little bit differently, but it ultimately was start with the eye, then move to the beak, and then do these stitches like this and those stitches like this. And hey, presto, you've got a bird. And it just felt a little bit sort of, oh, look, there's another one. Rather than the sort of excitement and the joy that comes out of it.
It'd take me a while of celebrating when a bird came out right before I got to that point.
There were about 20 years of birds, in fairness.
What are you trying to say with your art? Are you trying to, is it, get people to appreciate old architecture? Is there something you're trying to say with each piece, or this is way I saw this and it came out and enjoy it or not? How do you?
A little bit of all of those things, I think. Some of them are kind of just like I was saying before about the post-apocalyptic world, you know, that I find very interesting, what's now important. So yes, that there's, just because there's one in front of me right now, there's a piece of with an abandoned church in it, and, you know, people sort of holding up there and finding, you know, just safety and security and you know, protection from the elements in there. And I suppose even when with COVID here, when it first started, for the first few weeks, there was just no traffic anyway. You could just cross the road, like a really busy dual carriageway, and there was just nothing. You sort of forgot to look because there was just nothing anywhere. And it was quite like a little bit of that I was trying to capture in some of the work as well. The kind of just, if you were the, you know, one of the few people on Earth, what it would be like. More gloomy topics like that.
Yeah, kind of that desolate loneliness.
And, you know, also that there is beauty in things that are falling apart. You know, even a rusty washer that you find in the street that you can, you know, is beautiful if you really look at it. If you put a fancy frame around it and stuck it in a gallery, it would, you know, it would look like this sort of amazing little jewel. But it's just, it's just a rusty washer. That's useless. We'll throw it away. But, you know, things can decay in a very beautiful way as well. It's not all the time, obviously.
there's a lot of photographers who have made careers on taking photos of dead, decaying, dying things, plants, old buildings, whatever it is. No, there's beauty in all of it. There's colors that are not in new things that weathering and everything else puts into it. No, it's you just got to stop and look. That's all you got to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's all still there. There's beauty around you, even in the strangest places.
Yeah. So classes, how do people, I mean, we offer classes. What are you doing on the sharing and teaching end of things?
I'm starting to do some classes based on what I've been doing. So that I've done a few online classes. I quite like to YouTube as a method of just, I don't like this whole feeling that I have some kind of special secret way of sewing that no one's allowed to know about. It just seems a bit, I like to share. If I found a cool technique and a way I think's really interesting, I'd want someone to know how they could do it, not out of arrogance again, just because I think, well, it might be useful to somebody. So I think that's perhaps a way I'd like to go, I think, in the future. Is I do enjoy teaching and sort of sharing what I do. Just because I don't like this whole sort of secrets thing, you know. It's if you'd like to know how I do something or other, then fine, I'll tell you exactly how I do it. It's not a problem. But yeah, so I have done some, you know, quite a few workshops and things in the past, but I'm hoping to do some more live ones. I'm not a huge fan of the I don't mind, you know, proper, you know, online workshops where you've got, you know, you're kind of demonstrating in front of you, but I don't like just sort of standing staring at my own face, holding up things going, look, you can do this. That's just weird. But yes, so I do YouTube and some actual video live workshops too.
Because that's the other part. Your process is a long-term process. It's not like you can teach four stitches and send them on their way to work on a project. I mean, there's so much to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even if you were to do a day school, you could go, right, okay, well, we'll now stitch around these squares. And we'll now, so let's chop them all up, put them back together again, put them in the washing machine. Well, let's all stare at the washing machine for the next hour, shall we? You know, it's a tricky one to get across, which is why I haven't done a huge number on this particular subject yet, but it is something I would very much like to do more of, because, you know, I think it's fun, and a lot of people seem to, I suppose I was also scared that because it's quite dark and gloomy, nobody would like it, but a lot of people seem to like them, even if they wouldn't hang them on their walls or they wouldn't use abandoned buildings. They like the techniques and the piecing fabrics together. So even if they don't want a big gloomy picture on their wall, they might still like, you know, to have the techniques that I show in a maybe bright and happy world rather than dark and gloomy world.
Well, and when I saw yours, my husband and I just were at a St. Louis cemetery, a famous one. Of course, I can't think of the name of it. And I took a lot of photos of the old mausoleums that were there. And I thought, now I wish I'd taken more of a few of them, because I think the technique you use would work so well to capture that whole trip that we took. Just so to take one photo and to interpret it into embroidery like you do would be, for me, a capture of that whole memory of the whole camping trip my husband and I took. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah, it does. And I suppose it was I'll be honest, I'll just say it was a fear that nobody was going to like it. And certainly no one would want a workshop in it, sort of idea, you know, that, oh, do you know, it's too messy and grubby and, you know, gloomy. But it seems to have been very, you know, very well received from workshops I have done. So, and, you know, I don't know, you kind of expect that you'd start this workshop and you just have this whole sort of room full of like gloomy goths out there going, go on then, show us. But it's not like that at all.
Okay, so now that's a picture in my mind right now. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a little weird. Yeah, we don't want that.
Oh, I like gloomy goths. It's just, there's not a huge number in the world of embroidery.
No, there aren't. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're generally happy with bright and, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. No, there's a beauty. See, that's the thing is it's not, to me, it doesn't strike me as dark and gloomy at all. It's just a different kind of beauty that you bring out in the art from whatever structure that you decide to use. Mm-hmm. There's just a texture that you put in there and a whole different kind of visual beauty that doesn't show up elsewhere. I mean, I enjoyed them.
Oh, well, thank you. No, that means a lot because it's, well, like I say, you sort of, especially when you first put one out in the world, as it were, and you sort of, you've gone from these sort of little, what I call little chocolate boxy kind of birds. You know, again, I don't mean to disrespect the pieces that I made. You know, I think that, you know, they're pretty in their own way, but they're just not very me.
And I don't think everything needs to be pretty. I mean, you know, there is, I think when I see your pieces, it invokes a story. That's what I see. It's not necessarily dark. I just, you know, like the staircase. Okay, it makes you do. You make you go up the staircase. So it's like you're telling a story with your art. That's what I'm intriguing about it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think for a lot of people, it seems different. Seems to sort of evoke different things in people, whether it's via dreams or memories of somewhere they went as a child, or you know, old churches that they may have gone to, or something like that. It's a sort of it's a very, I don't know. It's like they mean different things to different people. The same piece can, I suppose, it's sort of slight abstraction can sort of just resonate with different people in a different way.
Yeah, no, that was for me. It was some of your pieces. Exactly the same thing. Oh, I start, my mind just starts conjuring up stories and what went on in that building and like the theater, how many performances and what were they? And yeah, it's, it just gets your mind working. Yep.
Yeah. And I managed to even look at it in terms of the, after a while, I was thinking of, because when I said that piece had come out too bright and shiny, It was one of my, the pieces are based on that theater. And so I sort of thought about it for a while and I thought, well, I mean, there would have been a lot of color going on in there at the time, you know, a huge amount of, you know, costumes and sets and bright things. So go with it still. It's fine. It'll be okay. Just because it's not gloomy, it'll be okay.
Well, Ruth, this has been so much fun. Your art is absolutely amazing. Thanks for sharing with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's really terrific. All right, gothicdecay.com is where you go see all that and see about our upcoming classes. And thanks again, Ruth, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you.